Lady Eithne, I... Enough of this, Eithne said sharply. Enough. Control yourself, Brienne. Geralt laughed dryly. There you have your destiny, Lady of the Forest. I respect your doggedness and your fight, but I know that soon you will be fighting alone. The last dryad of Brocylon, sending dryads who nonetheless still remember their real names to their deaths. In spite of everything, I wish you fortune, Eithne. Farewell.
Geralt,
Ciri whispered, still sitting motionless, with her head lowered.
Don't leave me, all by myself.
White wolf, Eithne said, embracing the little girl's hunched back. Did you have to wait until she asked you? Not to abandon her? To remain with her until the end? Why do you wish to abandon her at this moment? To leave her all alone? Where do you wish to flee to, Gwyn Blythe? And from what? Ciri's head slumped further down, but she did not cry. Until the end, the Witcher said, nodding. Very well, Ciri. You will not be alone. I will be with you. Do not fear anything. Eithne took the goblet from Brienne's trembling hands and raised it up.
Can you read old runes, White Wolf?
Yes, I can.
Read what is engraved on the goblet. It is from Craig An. It was drunk from by kings whom no one now remembers.
Duethenan, Aifkiran, Kairme, Glaedith, Inaesith?
Do you know what that means?
The sword of destiny has two blades. You are one of them.
Stand up, child of the Elder Blood.
The dryad's voice clanged like steel in an order which could not be defied, a will which had to be yielded to.
Drink. It is the water of Brocylon.
Geralt bit his lips and stared at Eithne's silver eyes. He did not look at Ciri, who was slowly bringing her lips to the edge of the goblet. He had seen it before, once, long ago. The convulsions, the tremors, the incredible, horrifying, slowly dwindling cry, and the emptiness, torpor and apathy in the slowly opening eyes. He had seen it before. Ciri drank. A tear rolled slowly down Brienne's unmoving face.
That will do.
Eithne took the goblet away, placed it on the ground, and stroked the little girl's hair, which fell onto her shoulders in mousy waves.
Oh, child of the Elder Blood, she said, choose. Do you wish to remain in Brocylon, or do you follow your destiny?
The Witcher shook his head in disbelief. Ciri was flushed and breathing a little more quickly. And nothing else. Nothing.
I wish to follow my destiny,
she said brightly, looking the dryad in the eyes.
Then let it be,
Eithne said, coldly and tersely. Brienne sighed aloud.
I wish to be alone,
Eithne said, turning her back on them.
Please leave.
Brienne took hold of Ciri and touched Geralt's arm, but the Witcher pushed her arm away.
Thank you, Eithne, he said.
The dryad slowly turned to face him.
What are you thanking me for?
For destiny, he smiled. For your decision, for that was not the water of Brocylon, was it? It was Ciri's destiny to return home, but you, Eithne, played the role of destiny. And for that I thank you.
How little you know of destiny, the dryad said bitterly. How little you know, Witcher. How little you see. How little you understand. You thank me. You thank me for the role I have played? For a vulgar spectacle? For a trick, a deception, a hoax? For the sword of destiny being made, as you judge, of wood dipped in gold paint? Then go further. Do not thank, but expose me. Have it your own way. Prove that the arguments are in your favor. Fling your truth in my face. Show me the triumph of sober human truth, thanks to which, in your opinion, you gain mastery of the world. This is the water of Broccolon. A little still remains. Dare you, O conqueror of the world?
Geralt, although annoyed by her words, hesitated, but only for a moment. The water of Broccolon, even if it were authentic, would have no effect on him. He was completely immune to the toxic, hallucinogenic tannins. But there was no way it could have been the water of Broccolon. Ciri had drunk it, and nothing had happened. He reached for the goblet with both hands and looked into the dryad's silver eyes. The ground rushed from under his feet all at once and hurled him on his back. The powerful oak tree whirled around and shook. He fumbled all around himself with his numb arms and opened his eyes with difficulty. It was as though he were throwing off a marble tombstone. He saw above him Brienne's tiny face, and beyond her, Eithne's eyes shining like quicksilver. And other eyes, as green as emeralds. No. Brighter, like spring grass. The medallion around his neck was quivering, vibrating.
"Gwyn Blythe," he heard. "Watch carefully. No, closing your eyes will not help you at all. Look. Look at your destiny. Do you remember?"
A sudden explosion of light rending a curtain of smoke. Huge candelabras, heavy with candles, dripping garlands of wax. Stone walls, a steep staircase. Descending the staircase, a green-eyed, mousy-haired girl in a small circlet with an intricately carved gemstone, in a silver-blue gown, with a train held up by a page in a short scarlet jacket.
"Do you remember?"
His own voice speaking. Speaking.
"I shall return in 6 years."
A bower. Warmth. The scent of flowers. The intense, monotonous hum of bees. He alone on his knees, giving a rose to a woman with mousy locks spilling from beneath a narrow gold band. Rings set with emeralds, large green cabochons, on the fingers taking the rose from his hand.
"Return here," the woman said. "Return here should you change your mind. Your destiny will be waiting."
"I shall never return here," he thought. "I never went back there. I never returned to..."
"Whither?"
"Mousy hair. Green eyes."
His voice again in the darkness, in a gloom in which everything was engulfed.
"There are only fires. Fires all the way to the horizon. A cloud of sparks in the purple smoke. Beltane. May Day Eve. Dark violet eyes, shining in a pale triangular face, veiled by a black, rippling shock of curls, look out from the clouds of smoke. Yennefer.
Too little."
The apparition's thin lips suddenly twist. A tear rolls down the pale cheek, quickly, quicker and quicker, like a drop of wax down a candle.
"Too little. Something more is needed.
Yennefer.
Nothingness for nothingness,"
the apparition says in Eithne's voice.
"The nothingness and void in you, conqueror of the world, who is unable even to win the woman he loves, who walks away and flees when his destiny is within reach. The sword of destiny has two blades. You are one of them, but what is the other, white wolf?"
"There is no destiny."
His own voice.
"There is none. None. It does not exist. The only thing that everyone is destined for is death."
"That is the truth,"
says the woman with the mousy hair and mysterious smile. That is the truth, Geralt. The woman is wearing a silvery suit of armour, bloody, dented and punctured by the points of pikes or halberds. Blood drips in a thin stream from the corner of her mysteriously and hideously smiling mouth.
You sneer at destiny, she says, still smiling. You sneer at it, trifle with it. The sword of destiny has two blades. You are one of them. It's the second, death. But it is we who die. Die because of you. Death cannot catch up with you, so it must settle for us. Death dogs your footsteps, white wolf. But others die because of you. Do you remember me?
Calanthe.
You can save him.
The voice of Eithne from behind the curtain of smoke.
You can save him, child of the Elder Blood, before he plunges into the nothingness which he has come to love, into the black forest which has no end.
Eyes as green as spring grass. A touch. Voices crying in chorus, incomprehensibly. Faces. He could no longer see anything. He was plummeting into the chasm, into the void, into darkness. The last thing he heard was Eithne's voice.
Let it be so.
Chapter 7.
Geralt, wake up. Please, wake up.
He opened his eyes and saw the sun, a golden ducat with distinct edges, high up above the treetops, beyond the turbid veil of the morning mist. He was lying on damp, spongy moss, and a hard root was digging into his back. Ciri was kneeling beside him, tugging at his jacket.
Curses!
He cleared his throat and looked around.
Where am I? How did I end up here?
I don't know, she answered. I woke up a moment ago, here beside you. I feel frozen. I can't remember how. Do you know what? It's magic.
You're probably right, he said, sitting up and pulling pine needles from his collar. You're probably right, Ciri. Bloody water of Broccolon. Looks like the Dryads are enjoying themselves at our expense.
He stood up, picked up his sword, which was lying alongside him, and slung the strap across his back.
Ciri?
Uh-huh.
You were also enjoying yourself at my expense.
Me?
You're the daughter of Pavetta and the granddaughter of Calanthe of Sintra. You knew who I was from the very beginning, didn't you?
No, she blushed. Not from the beginning. You lifted the curse from my daddy, didn't you?
Well, that's not true, he said, shaking his head. Your mama did, and your grandmama. I only helped.
But my nanny said, she said that I'm destined, because I'm a surprise. A child of surprise. Geralt?
Ciri. He looked at her, shaking his head and smiling. Believe me, you're the greatest surprise I could have come across.
Ha!
The little girl's face brightened up.
It's true. I'm destined. My nanny said a witcher would come who would have white hair and would take me away. But Grandmama yelled. Oh, never mind. Tell me where you're taking me.
Back home, to Sintra.
Ah, but I thought you...
You'll have time to think on the way. Let's go, Ciri. We must leave Broccolon. It isn't a safe place.
I'm not afraid.
But I am.
Grandmama said that witches aren't afraid of anything.
Grandmama overstated the facts. Let's go, Ciri. If I only knew where we...
He looked up at the sun.
Right. Let's risk it. We'll go this way.
No.
Ciri wrinkled her nose and pointed in the opposite direction.
That way. Over there.
And how do you know, may I ask?
I just know.
She shrugged and gave him a helpless, surprised emerald look.
Somehow, somewhere over there, I don't know.
Pavetta's daughter, he thought. A child. A child of the Elder Blood. She might have inherited something from her mother. Siri. He tugged open his shirt and drew out his medallion. Touch this.
Oh, she said, opening her mouth. What a dreadful wolf. What fangs he has.
Touch it.
Oh, my.
The Witcher smiled. He had also felt the sudden vibration of the medallion, the sharp wave running through the silver chain.
It moved, Ciri sighed. It moved.
I know. Let's go, Ciri. You lead.
It's magic, isn't it?
Naturally.
It was as he had expected. The little girl could sense the direction. How, he did not know. But soon, sooner than he had expected, they came out onto a track, onto a forked three-way junction. It was the border of Brokilon, according to humans at least. Eithne did not recognize it, he remembered. Ciri bit her lip, wrinkled her nose, and hesitated, looking at the junction, at the sandy, rutted track furrowed by hooves and cartwheels. But Geralt now knew where he was, and did not want to depend on her uncertain abilities. He set off along the road, heading eastwards towards Brugge. Ciri, still frowning, was looking back towards the west.
That leads to Nastrog Castle, he jibed. Are you missing Kistrin?
The little girl grunted and followed him obediently, but looked back several times.
What is it, Ciri?
I don't know, she whispered. But we're going the wrong way, Geralt.
Why? We're going to Brugge, to King Venslav, who lives in a splendid castle. We shall take baths and sleep on a feather bed.
It's a bad road, she said. A bad road.
That's true. I've seen better. Don't be sniffy, Ciri. Let's go, with a will.
They went around an overgrown bend, and it turned out Ciri had been right. They were suddenly, quickly surrounded from all sides. Men in conical helmets, chainmail, and dark blue tunics with the gold and black checkered pattern of Verden on their chests. They circled the pair, but none of the men approached or reached for a weapon.
Whence and whither?
Barked a thick-set individual, in worn-out green apparel, standing before Geralt with bandy legs set wide apart. His face was as swarthy and wrinkled as a prune. A bow and white-fletched arrows protruded behind him, high above his head.
We've come from Burnt Stump,
the Witcher lied effortlessly, squeezing Ciri's little hand knowingly.
Am I going home to Brugge? What's happening?
Ryal service,
the dark-faced individual said courteously, as though he'd only then noticed the sword on Geralt's back.
We... Bring him here, young'uns,
yelled someone standing further down the road. The mercenaries parted.
Don't look, Ciri, Geralt said quickly. Avert your eyes, don't look.
A fallen tree lay on the road, blocking the way with a tangle of boughs. Long white splinters radiated from the partly hacked and broken trunk standing in the roadside thicket. A loaded wagon covered with a tarpaulin stood before the tree. Two small, shaggy horses, stuck with arrows and exposing yellow teeth, were lying on the ground, caught up in the shafts and halters. One was still alive and was snorting heavily and kicking. There were also people lying in dark patches of blood, soaked into the sand, hanging over the side of the wagon and hunched over the wheels. Two men slowly emerged from among the armed men gathered around the wagon, to be joined by a third. The others, there were around 10 of them, stood motionless, holding their horses.
What happened?
The Witcher asked, standing so as to block out Ciri's view of the massacre. A beady-eyed man in a short coat of mail and high boots gave him a searching look and audibly rubbed his bristly chin. He had a worn, shiny leather bracer of the kind archers use on his left forearm.
Ambush, he said curtly. Eerie wives did for these merchants. We're looking into it. Eerie wives? Ambushing merchants? You can see for yourself,
the beady-eyed man pointed.
Stuck with arrows, like urchins. On the highway. They're becoming more and more impudent, those forest hags. You can't just not venture into the forest now. You can't even travel the road by the forest. And you?
The Witcher asked, squinting.
Who are you? Urville's men, from the Nastrog squad. We were serving under Baron Frexinet, but the Baron was lost in Brokilon.
Ciri opened her mouth, but Geralt squeezed her hand hard, ordering her to stay quiet.
Blood for blood, I say,
roared the beady-eyed man's companion, a giant in a brass-studded caftan.
Blood for blood. You can't let that go. First Phrixenet and the kidnapped princess from Sintra, and now merchants. By the gods, vengeance, vengeance, I say. For if not, you'll see tomorrow or the next day, they'll start killing people on their own thresholds.
Brick's right, the beady-eyed one said, isn't he? And you, fellow, where are you from?
From Brugge, the witcher lied.
And a girl, your daughter?
Aye.
Geralt squeezed Ciri's hand again.
From Brugge?
Brick frowned.
So, I'll tell you, fellow, that your king, Venslav, is emboldening the monstrosities right now. He doesn't want to join forces with Ervil, nor with Viractus of Kerak. But if we marched and broke along from three sides, we'd finally destroy that scum.
How did the slaughter happen?
Geralt asked slowly.
Does anybody know? Did any of the merchants survive?
There aren't any witnesses, the beady-eyed one said. But we know what happened. Jungans, a forester, can read spores like a book. Tell him, Jungans.
Well, said the one with a wrinkled face, it were like this. The merchants were travelling along the highway, and their way were blocked. You see, sir, that fallen pine lying across the road, freshly felled. There are tracks in the thicket, want to see? Well, when the merchants stopped to clear away the tree, they were shot, just like that. Over there, from the bushes by that crooked birch, there are tracks there too. And the arrows, mark you, all dryad work, fletchings stuck on with resin, shafts bound with bast.
I see,
the witcher interrupted, looking at the bodies.
Some of them, I think, survived the arrows and had their throats cut with knives.
One more man emerged from behind the group of mercenaries standing in front of him. He was skinny and short, in an elk-hide caftan. He had black, short hair, and his cheeks were blue from closely shaved black beard growth. One glance at the small, narrow hands in short, black, fingerless gloves, at the pale, fish-like eyes, at his sword and at the hafts of the daggers stuck into his belt and down his left boot, was all the witcher needed. Geralt had seen too many murderers not to recognise one more instantly.
"You've a keen eye," said the black-haired man, extremely slowly. "Indeed, you see much."
"And well he does," said the beady-eyed man. "Let him tell his king what he saw. Venslav still swears eerie wives shouldn't be killed, because they are agreeable and good. I'll bet he visits them on May Day and ruts them. Perhaps they're good for that. We'll find out for ourselves if we take one alive."
"Nor even half dead," Brick cackled. "Aye, who's that blood-eyed druid? Almost noon, but no sign of him. We must off."
"What do you mean to do?"
Geralt asked, without releasing Ciri's hands.
"What business is it of yours?" the black-haired man hissed.
"Oh, why so sharp right away, Levesque?"
the beady-eyed one asked, smiling foully.
"We're honest men. We have no secrets. Ervil is sending us a druid, a great magician, who can talk with trees. Him will guide us into the forest to avenge Phrixenet and try and rescue the princess. We aren't out for a picnic, fellow, but on a punitive expedition,
the black-haired man Levesque prompted.
"Aye, took the words out of my mouth. So then, go on your way, fellow, for it may get hot here anon."
"Aye," Levesque drawled, looking at Ciri. "'Twill be dangerous here, particularly with a young un. Here he was, are just desperate for girls like that. Aye, little maid, is your mama at home waiting?"
Ciri, trembling, nodded.
"'Twould be disastrous,"
the black-haired one continued, not taking his eye off her. "Were you not to make it home, she would surely race to King Vinslav and say,
you were lax with the dryads, king, and now you have my daughter and husband on your conscience.
Who knows? Perhaps Venslav would weigh up an alliance with Ervil once more."
"Leave them, Mr. Levesque," Jungan snarled, and his wrinkled face wrinkled up even more. "Let them go."
"Farewell, little maid," Levesque said,
and held out his hand to stroke Ciri on the head. Ciri shuddered and withdrew.
"What is it? Are you afraid?"
"You have blood on your hand," the witcher said softly.
"Ah,"
Levesque said, raising his hand.
"Indeed. It's their blood, the merchants. I checked to see if any of them had survived, but alas, the eerie wives shoot accurately."
"Eerie wives?"
said Ciri in a trembling voice, not reacting to the witcher's squeeze of her hand.
"Oh, noble knights, you're mistaken. It could not be dryads."
"What are you squeaking about, little maid?"
The pale eyes of the black-haired man narrowed. Geralt glanced to the right and left, estimating the distances.
"It wasn't Dryad, Sir Knight," Ciri repeated. "It's obvious."
"Oh, aye?
I mean, that tree. That tree was chopped down with an axe. But no Dryad would ever chop a tree down, would they?"
"Indeed," Levesque said, and glanced at the beady-eyed man. "Oh, what a clever little girl you are. Too clever."
The Witcher had already seen his thin, gloved hands creeping like a black spider towards the haft of his dagger. Although Levesque had not taken his eyes off Ciri, Geralt knew the blow would be aimed at him. He waited for the moment when Levesque touched his weapon, while the beady-eyed man held his breath. Three movements, just three. His silver-studded forearm slammed into the side of the black-haired man's head. Before he fell, the Witcher was standing between Jungans and the beady-eyed man, and his sword, hissing out of the scabbard, whined in the air, slashing open the temple of brick, the giant in the brass-studded caftan.
"Run, Ciri!"
The beady-eyed man, who was drawing his sword, leapt, but was not fast enough. The Witcher slashed him across his chest, diagonally downwards, and immediately, taking advantage of the blow's momentum, upwards from a kneeling position, cutting the mercenary open in a bloody X.
"Men!"
Jungans yelled at the rest, who were frozen in astonishment. "Over here!" Ciri leapt into a crooked beech tree and scampered like a squirrel up the branches, disappearing among the foliage. The forester sent an arrow after her but missed. The remaining men ran over, breaking up into a semicircle, pulling out bows and arrows from quivers. Geralt, still kneeling, put his fingers together and struck with the yard sign. Not at the bowmen, for they were too far away, but at the sandy road in front of them, spraying them in a cloud of sand. Jungans, leaping aside, nimbly drew another arrow from his quiver.
"No!"
Levesque yelled, springing up from the ground with his sword in his right hand and a dagger in his left.
"Leave him, Jungans!"
The Witcher spun around smoothly, turning to face him.
"He's mine," Levesque said,
shaking his head and wiping his cheek and mouth with his forearm.
"Leave him to me."
Geralt, crouching, started to circle. But Levesque did not. Instead, attacking at once, leaping forward in two strides.
"He's good," the Witcher thought,
working hard to connect with the killer's blade with a short moulinet, avoiding the dagger's jab with a half turn. He intentionally did not reply, but leapt back, counting on Levesque trying to reach him with a long extended thrust and losing his balance. But the killer was no novice. He dropped into a crouch and also moved around in a semicircle with soft, feline steps. He unexpectedly bounded forward, swung his sword and whirled, shortening the distance. The Witcher did not meet him halfway, but restricted himself to a swift, high feint, which forced the killer to dodge. Levesque stooped over, offered a carte, hiding the hand with the dagger behind his back. The Witcher did not attack this time either, did not move in, but described a semicircle again, skirting around him.
"Aha," Levesque drawled, straightening up. "Shall we prolong the game? Why not? You can never have too much amusement."
He leapt, spun, struck once, twice, thrice in a rapid rhythm. A cut from above with his sword, and immediately from the left with a flat, scything blow of his dagger. The Witcher did not disturb the rhythm. Parried, leapt back, and once again circled, forcing the killer to move around. Levesque suddenly drew back, circling in the opposite direction.
"Every game," he hissed through clenched teeth, "must have its end. What would you say to a single blow, trickster? A single blow, and then we'll shoot your little brat down from the tree. How about that?"
Geralt saw that Levesque was watching his shadow, waiting for it to reach his opponent, indicating that he had the sun in his eyes. Geralt stopped circling to make the killer's job easier, and narrowed his pupils into vertical slits, two narrow lines. In order to maintain the illusion, he screwed his eyes up a little, pretending to be blinded. Levesque leapt, spun, keeping his balance by extending his dagger hand out sideways, and struck with a simply impossible bend of his wrist, upwards, aiming at the witch's crotch. Geralt shot forward, spun, deflected the blow, bending his arm and wrist equally impossibly, throwing the killer backwards with the momentum of the parry, and slashing him across his left cheek with the tip of his blade. Levesque staggered, grabbing his face. The Witcher twisted into a half-turn, shifted his body weight onto his left leg, and cleaved open his opponent's carotid artery with a short blow. Levesque curled up, bleeding profusely, dropped to his knees, bent over, and fell head first onto the sand. Geralt slowly turned towards Jungens. Jungens, contorting his wrinkled face in a furious grimace, took aim with his bow. The Witcher crouched, gripping his sword in both hands. The remaining mercenaries also raised their bows in dead silence.
"What are you waiting for?" the forester roared. "Shoot! Shoot him!"
He stumbled, staggered, tottered forwards, and fell on his face with an arrow sticking out of his back. The arrow's shaft had striped fletchings made from a pheasant's flight feathers, dyed yellow in a concoction of tree bark. The arrows flew with a whistle and hiss in long, flat parabolas from the black wall of the forest. They flew apparently slowly and calmly, their fletchings sighing, and it seemed as though they picked up speed and force as they struck their targets. And they struck unerringly, scything down the Nastrog mercenaries, knocking them over into the sand, inert and mown down, like sunflowers hit with a stick. The ones who survived rushed towards the horses, jostling one another. The arrows continued to whistle, catching up with them as they ran, hitting them as they sat in the saddle. Only three managed to rouse their horses to a gallop and ride off, yelling, their spurs bloodying their mount's flanks. But not even they got far. The forest closed up, blocking the way. Suddenly, the sandy highway, bathed in sunlight, disappeared. It was now a dense, impenetrable wall of black tree trunks. The mercenaries, terrified and stupefied, spurred their horses, but the arrows flew unceasingly and hit them, knocking them from their saddles among the hoof falls and neighing of the horses and screams. And afterwards, a silence fell. The wall of trees blocking the highway shimmered, became blurred, shone brightly, and vanished. The road could be seen again, and on it stood a grey horse, and on the grey horse sat a rider, mighty, with a flaxen, fan-shaped beard in a jerkin of sealskin with a tartan woolen sash. The grey horse, turning its head away and champing at the bit, moved forward, lifting its forehooves high, snorting and becoming agitated by the corpses and the smell of blood. The rider, upright in the saddle, raised a hand, and a sudden gust of wind struck the tree's branches. From the undergrowth on the distant edge of the forest emerged small shapes in tight-fitting garments, patched green and brown, with faces streaked with walnut-shell dye.
"Yaidmil ved brochilone," the rider called. "Fael anavurved."
"Fael,"
replied a voice from the forest, like a gust of wind. The green and brown shapes began to disappear, one after the other, melting into the thicket of the forest. Only one remained, with flowing hair the colour of honey. She took several steps and approached.
"Va Fael, Gwynblaith,"
she called, coming even closer.
"Farewell, Mona," the Witcher said. "I will not forget you."
"Forget me,"
she responded firmly, adjusting her quiver on her back.
"There is no Mona. Mona was a dream. I am Brienne. Brienne of Brokilon."
She waved at him once more and disappeared. The Witcher turned around.
"Mousak," he said, looking at the rider on the grey horse.
"Geralt,"
the rider nodded, eyeing him up and down coldly.
"An interesting encounter, but let us begin with the most important things. Where is Ciri?"
"Here,"
the girl yelled from the foliage.
"Can I come down yet?"
"Yes, you may," the Witcher said.
"But I don't know how."
"The same way as you climbed up, just the other way around."
"I'm afraid. I'm right at the very top."
"Get down," I said. "We need to have a serious conversation, young lady."
"What about?"
"About why the bloody hell you climbed up there instead of running into the forest. I would have followed you instead of... Oh, blow it. Get down."
"I did what the cat in the story did. Whatever I do, it's always wrong. Why, I'd like to know."
"I would too," the druid said, dismounting. "I would also like to know. And your grandmama, Queen Calanthe, would like to know too. Come on, climb down, princess."
Leaves and dry branches fell from the tree. Then there was a sharp crack of tearing material, and finally Ciri appeared, sliding astride the trunk. She had picturesque shreds instead of a hood on her jacket.
"Uncle Mousak!"
"In person."
The druid embraced and cuddled the little girl.
"Did Grandmama send you, Uncle? Is she very worried?"
"Not very," Mousak smiled. "She is too busy soaking her switch. The way to Sintra, Ciri, will take us some time. Devote it to thinking up an explanation of your deeds. It ought to be, if you want to benefit from my counsel, a very short and matter-of-fact explanation, one which can be given very, very quickly. For in any case, I judge you'll be screaming at the end of it, Princess. Very, very loudly. Ciri grimaced painfully, wrinkled up her nose, snorted softly, and her hands involuntarily went towards the endangered place.
Let's go, Geralt said, looking around. Let's go, Mausak.
Chapter 8
No, the druid said. Calanthe has changed her plans. She does not want the marriage of Ciri and Kistrin to go ahead now. She has her reasons. Additionally, I presume I don't have to explain that following that dreadful scandal with the sham ambush on the merchants, King Urville has gone down a long way in my estimation, and my estimation matters in the kingdom. No, we won't even stop off at Nastrog. I'll take the last straight to Sintra. Ride with us, Geralt.
What for?
The Witcher glanced at Ciri, who was now slumbering beneath a tree, wrapped in Mausak's jerkin.
You well know what for. That child, Geralt, is linked to you by destiny. For the third time, yes, the third, your paths have crossed. Metaphorically, of course, particularly as regards the previous two occasions. You surely can't call it coincidence.
What does it matter what I call it?
The Witcher smiled wryly. The essence is not in the name, Mausak. Why ought I to ride to Sintra? I have already been to Sintra. I have already, as you described it, crossed paths. What of it?
Geralt, you demanded a vow from Calanthe, then from Pavetta and her husband. The vow has been kept. Ciri is the child of destiny. Destiny demands that I take the child and turn her into a witcher, a little girl. Take a good look at me, Mausak. Can you imagine me as a comely lass? To hell with witchering, the druid said annoyed. What are you talking about? What has the one to do with the other? No, Geralt, I see that you understand nothing. I shall have to use simple words. Listen, any fool, including you, may demand a vow, may exact a promise, and will not become remarkable because of it. It is the child who is extraordinary, and the bond which comes into being when the child is born is extraordinary. Need I be more clear? Very well, Geralt. From the moment Ciri was born, what you wanted and what you planned to do ceased to matter. And what you don't want, and what you mean to give up, doesn't make any difference either. You don't bloody matter, don't you understand? Don't shout. You'll wake her up. Our destiny is asleep, and when she wakes, Mausak, one must occasionally give up. Even the most extraordinary things. But you know, the druid looked at him coldly, you will never have a child of your own.
Yes.
And you're still giving her up?
Yes, I am. I'm surely permitted to, aren't I?
You are, Mausak said. Indeed, but it is risky. There is an old prophecy saying that the sword of destiny has two blades.
Geralt completed the sentence. I've heard it.
Or do as you think fit.
The druid turned his head away and spat.
Just think, I was prepared to stick my neck out for you. You. Me. Unlike you, I believe in destiny, and I knew that it is hazardous to trifle with a two-edged sword. Don't trifle with it, Geralt. Take advantage of the chance which is presenting itself. Turn what connects you to Ciri into the normal, healthy bond of a child with its guardian. For if you do not, then that bond may manifest itself differently, more terribly, in a negative and destructive way. I want to protect you both from that. If you wanted to take her, I would not protest. I would take upon myself the risk of explaining why to Calanthe. How do you know Ciri would want to go with me? Because of some old prophecies? No, Mausak said gravely. Because she only fell asleep after you cuddled her. Because she mutters your name and searches for your hand in her sleep. Enough.
Geralt got up, because I'm liable to get emotional. Farewell, bearded one. My compliments to Calanthe. And think something up, for Ciri's sake.
You will not escape, Geralt.
From destiny.
The Witcher tightened the girth of the captured horse.
No,
the druid said, looking at the sleeping child.
From her.
The Witcher nodded and jumped into the saddle. Mousesack sat motionless, poking a stick into the dying campfire. He rode slowly away, through heather as high as his stirrups, across the hillside leading into the valley, towards the Black Forest.
Geralt!
He turned around. Ciri was standing on the brow of a hill, a tiny grey figure with windblown mousy hair.
Don't go!
She waved.
Don't go!
She yelled shrilly.
Don't go!
I have to, he thought. I have to, Ciri, because I always do.
You won't get away,
she cried.
Don't go thinking that. You can't run away. I'm your destiny. Do you hear?
There is no destiny, he thought. It does not exist. The only thing that everyone is destined for is death. Death is the other blade of the two-edged sword. I am the first blade, and the second is death, which dogs my footsteps. I cannot, I may not expose you to that, Ciri.
I am your destiny!
The words reached his ears from the hilltop, more softly, more despairingly. He nudged the horse with his heel and rode straight ahead, heading deep into the black, cold and boggy forest, as though into an abyss. Into the pleasant, familiar shade, into the gloom which seemed to have no end. Something More. Chapter 1. When hooves suddenly rapped on the timbers of the bridge, Jurga did not even raise his head. He just howled softly, released the wheel rim he was grappling with, and crawled under the cart as quickly as he could. Flattened, scraping his back against the rough manure and mud caked onto the underside of the vehicle, he whined and trembled with fear. The horse moved slowly towards the cart. Jurga saw it place its hooves cautiously on the rotted, moss-covered timbers.
"Get out," the unseen horseman said.
Jurga's teeth chattered, and he pulled his head into his shoulders. The horse snorted and stamped.
"Easy, Roach," the horseman said.
Jurga heard him pat his mount on the neck.
"Get out from under there, fellow. I won't do you any harm."
The merchant did not believe the stranger's declaration in the slightest. There was something calming and at the same time intriguing in his voice, however, though it was by no means a voice which could be described as pleasant. Jurga, mumbling prayers to a dozen deities all at once, timidly stuck his head out from under the cart. The horseman had hair as white as milk, tied back from his forehead with a leather band, and a black woolen cloak falling over the rump of the chestnut mare. He did not look at Jurga. Leaning from his saddle, he was examining the cartwheel, sunk up to the hub between the bridge's broken beams. He suddenly raised his head, flicked a gaze over the merchant, and observed the undergrowth above the banks of the ravine. Jurga scrambled out, blinked and rubbed his nose with a hand, smearing wood tar from the wheel hub over his face. The horseman fixed dark, narrowed, piercing eyes as sharp as a spear tip on him. Jurga was silent.
"The two of us won't be able to pull it out," said the stranger finally, pointing at the stuck wheel. "Were you travelling alone?"
"There were three of us," Jurga stammered. "Servants, sir, but they fled, the scoundrels."
"I'm not surprised," said the horseman, looking under the bridge towards the bottom of the ravine. "I'm not surprised at all. I think you ought to do the same. Time is short."
Jurga did not follow the stranger's gaze. He did not want to look at the mass of skulls, ribs and shin bones scattered among the rocks, peeping out from the burdock and nettles covering the bottom of the dried-up stream. He was afraid that with just one more glance, one more glimpse of the black eye sockets, grinning teeth and cracked bones, something would snap in him. The remains of his desperate courage would escape like air from a fish's bladder, and he would dash back up the highway, stifling a scream, just as the carter and his lad had less than an hour before.
"What are you waiting for?"
the horseman asked softly, reining his horse around.
"For nightfall. It'll be too late then. They'll come for you as soon as it begins to get dark.
Or maybe even sooner. Let's go. Jump up behind me. Let's both get out of here as quick as we can.
But the cart, sir!
Jurga howled at the top of his voice, not knowing if from fear, despair, or rage.
And my goods? That's a whole year's work. I'd rather drop dead. I'm not leaving it.
I think you still don't know where the bloody hell you are, friend, the stranger said calmly, extending a hand towards the ghastly graveyard beneath the bridge. Won't leave your cart, you say? I tell you, when darkness falls, not even King Desmond's treasury will save you, never mind your lousy cart. What the hell came over you to take a shortcut through this wilderness? Don't you know what has infested this place since the war?
Jurga shook his head.
You don't know, nodded the stranger. But you've seen what's down there. It'd be difficult not to notice. That's all the other men who took a shortcut through here. And you say you won't leave your cart? And what, I wonder, do you have in your cart?
Jurga did not reply, but glowered at the horseman, trying to choose between oakum and old rags. The horseman did not seem particularly interested in the answer. He reassured his chestnut, who was chewing its bit and tossing its head.
"Please, sir," the merchant finally muttered. "Help me, save me, my eternal gratitude. Don't leave. I'll give you whatever you want, whatever you ask. Save me, sir."
The stranger, resting both hands on the pommel of his saddle, suddenly turned his head towards him.
"What did you say?"
Jurga opened his mouth but said nothing.
"You'll give me whatever I ask for. Say it again."
Jurga smacked his lips, closed his mouth, and wished he was agile enough to kick himself in the arse. His head was spinning with fantastic theories as to the reward that this weird stranger might demand. Most of them, including the privilege of weekly use of his rosy-cheeked young wife, did not seem as awful as the prospect of losing the cart, and certainly not as macabre as the possibility of ending up at the bottom of the canyon as one more bleached skeleton. His merchant's experience forced him into some rapid calculations. The horseman, although he did not resemble a typical ruffian, tramp or marauder, of which there were plenty on the roads after the war, surely wasn't a magnate or governor either, nor one of those proud little knights with a high opinion of themselves who derive pleasure from robbing the shirt off their neighbours' backs. Jurga reckoned him at no more than 20 pieces of gold. However, his commercial instincts stopped him from naming a price, so he limited himself to mumbling something about lifelong gratitude.
"I asked you," the stranger calmly reminded him, after waiting for the merchant to be quiet, "if you'll give me whatever I ask for."
There was no way out. Jurga swallowed, bowed his head, and nodded his agreement. The stranger, in spite of Jurga's expectations, did not laugh portentously. Quite the opposite. He did not show any sign of being delighted by his victory in the negotiations. Leaning over in the saddle, he spat into the ravine.
"What am I doing?" he said grimly. "What the fuck am I doing? Well, so be it. I'll try to get you out of this, though I don't know that it won't finish disastrously for us both. But if I succeed, in exchange, you will..."
Jurga curled up, close to tears.
"You will give me," the horseman in the black cloak suddenly and quickly recited, "whatever you come across at home on your return, but did not expect. Do you swear?"
Jurga groaned and nodded quickly.
"Good," the stranger grimaced. "And now, stand aside. It would be best if you got back onto the cart. The sun is about to set."
He dismounted and took his cloak from his shoulders. Jurga saw that the stranger was carrying a sword on his back, on a belt slung diagonally across his chest. He had a vague sense he'd once heard of people with a similar way of carrying a weapon. The black leather hip-length jacket with long sleeves sparkling with silver studs might have indicated that the stranger came from Novigrad or the surroundings, but the fashion for such dress had recently become widespread, particularly among youngsters, although this stranger was no youngster. After removing his saddlebags from his mount, the horseman turned around. A round medallion hung on a silver chain around his neck. He was holding a small metal-bound chest and an oblong parcel wrapped in skins and fastened with a strap under one arm.
"Aren't you under the cart yet?" he asked, approaching.
Jurga saw that a wolf's head with open jaws and armed with fangs was depicted on the medallion. he suddenly recalled.
"Would you be a witcher, sir?"
The stranger shrugged.
"You guess right. A witcher. Now, move away, to the other side of the cart. Don't come out from there and be silent. I must be alone for a while."
Jurga obeyed. He hunkered down by the wheel, wrapped in a mantle. He didn't want to look at what the stranger was doing on the other side of the cart, even less at the bones at the bottom of the ravine. So he looked at his boots and at the green, star-shaped shoots of moss growing on the bridge's rotten timbers. A witcher. The sun was setting. He heard footsteps. Slowly, very slowly, the stranger moved out from behind the cart into the center of the bridge. He had his back to Jurga, who saw that the sword on his back was not the sword he had seen earlier. Now it was a splendid weapon. The hilt, crossguard and fittings of the scabbard shone like stars. Even in the gathering darkness they reflected light, although there was almost none. Not even the golden purple glow, which a short while earlier had been hanging over the forest.
"Sir?"
The stranger turned his head. Jurga barely stifled a scream. The stranger's face was white. White and porous, like cheese drained and unwrapped from a cloth. And his eyes! Ye gods! Something howled inside Jurga. His eyes!
"Behind the cart, now!" the stranger rasped.
It was not the voice Jurga had heard before. The merchant suddenly felt his full bladder troubling him terribly. The stranger turned and walked further along the bridge. A witcher. The horse, tied to the cart's rack, snorted, neighed, and stamped its hooves dully on the beams. A mosquito buzzed above Jurga's ear. The merchant did not even move a hand to shoo it away. A second one joined it. Whole clouds of mosquitoes were buzzing in the thicket on the far side of the ravine. Buzzing. And howling. Jurga, clenching his teeth until they hurt, realized they were not mosquitoes. From the thickening darkness on the overgrown side of the ravine emerged some small, misshapen forms, less than 4 feet tall, horribly gaunt like skeletons. They stepped onto the bridge with a peculiar, heron-like gait, feet high, making staccato, jerky movements as they lifted their bony knees. Their eyes, beneath flat, dirty foreheads, shone yellow, and pointed little fangs gleamed white in wide, frog-like maws. They came closer, hissing. The stranger, as still as a statue in the center of the bridge, suddenly raised his right hand, making a bizarre shape with his fingers. The monstrous little beasts retreated, hissing loudly, before once again moving forwards, quickly, quicker and quicker on their long, spindly, taloned forefeet. Claws scraped on the timbers to the left as another monster jumped out from under the bridge, and the remaining ones on the bank rushed forwards in bewildering leaps. The stranger spun around on the spot, and the sword, which had suddenly appeared in his hand, flashed. The head of the creature, scrambling onto the bridge, flew 2 yards up into the air, trailing a ribbon of blood behind it. Then the white-haired man fell on a group of them and whirled, slashing swiftly all around him. The monsters, flailing their arms and wailing, attacked him from all sides, ignoring the luminous blade, cutting them like a razor. Jurga cowered, hugging the cart. Something fell right at his feet, bespattering him with gore. It was a long, bony hand, four-clawed and scaly, like a chicken's foot. The merchant screamed. He sensed something flitting past him. He cowered, intending to dive under the cart, just as something landed on his neck, and a scaly hand seized him by the temple and cheek. He covered his eyes, howling, and jerking his head, leapt to his feet and staggered into the middle of the bridge, stumbling over the corpses sprawled across the timbers. A battle was raging there, but Jurga could not see anything apart from a furious swarm, a mass within which the silver blade kept flashing.
"Help me!"
he howled, feeling the sharp fangs penetrating the felt of his hood and digging into the back of his head.
"Duck!"
He pressed his chin down onto his chest, looking out for the flash of the blade. It whined in the air and grazed his hood. Jurga heard a hideous, wet, crunching sound, and then a hot liquid gushed down his back. He fell to his knees, dragged down by the now inert weight hanging from his neck. He watched as 3 more monsters scuttled out from under the bridge, Leaping like bizarre grasshoppers, they latched onto the stranger's thighs. One of them, slashed with a short blow across its toad-like muzzle, took a few steps upright and fell onto the timbers. Another, struck with the very tip of the sword, collapsed in squirming convulsions. The remaining ones swarmed like ants over the white-haired man, pushing him towards the edge of the bridge. One flew out of the swarm, bent backwards, spurting blood, quivering and howling. And right then, the entire seething mass staggered over the edge and plummeted into the ravine. Jurga fell to the ground, covering his head with his hands. From below the bridge, he heard the monster's triumphant squeals, suddenly transforming into howls of pain. Those howls silenced by the whistling of the blade. Then from the darkness came the rattle of stones and the crunch of skeletons being trodden on and crushed. And then once again came the whistle of a falling sword and a despairing, blood-curdling shriek which suddenly broke off. And then there was only silence, interrupted by the sudden cry of a terrified bird deep in the forest among the towering trees. And then the bird fell silent too. Jurga swallowed, raised his head, and stood up with difficulty. It was still quiet. Not even the leaves rustled. The entire forest seemed to be dumbstruck with terror. Ragged clouds obscured the sky.
Hey!
He turned around, involuntarily protecting himself with raised arms. The Witcher stood before him, motionless, black, with a shining sword in his lowered hand. Jurga noticed he was standing somehow crookedly, leaning over to one side.
"What's the matter, sir?"
The Witcher did not reply. He took a step, clumsily and heavily, limping on his left leg. He held out a hand and grasped the cart. Jurga saw blood, black and shining, dripping onto the timbers.
"You're wounded, sir."
The Witcher did not reply. Looking straight into the merchant's eyes, he fell against the cart's box and slowly collapsed onto the bridge. Chapter 2.
"Careful! Easy does it! Under his head! One of you support his head!"
"Here! Here! Under the cart!"
"Ye gods! He'll bleed to death! Mr. Jurga! The blood's seeping through the dressing!
Quiet! Drive on, Pockvit. Make haste. Wrap him in a sheepskin, Mel. Can't you see how he shivers?
Shall I pour some vodka down his throat?"
"Can't you see he's unconscious? You astonish me, Vel. But give me that vodka. I need a drink. You dogs, you scoundrels, you rotten cowards, scarpering like that and leaving me all alone."
"Mr. Jurga, he said something."
"What? What's he saying?"
"Can't make it out. There seems to be a name."
"What name?" "Yennefer."
Chapter 3.
"Where am I?"
"Lie still, sir. Don't move, or everything will tear open again. Those vile creatures bit your thigh down to the bone. You've lost a deal of blood. Don't you know me? It's Jurga. You saved me on the bridge. Do you recall?" "Do you have a thirst?"
"A hell of one."
"Drink, sir, drink. You're burning with fever."
"Jurga, where are we?"
"We're riding in my cart. Don't say anything, sir. Don't move. We had to venture out of the forest towards human settlements. We must find someone with healing powers. What we've wrapped round your leg may be insufficient. The blood won't stop coming."
"Jurga."
"Yes, sir?"
"In my chest. Flacon. With green sealing wax. Strip off the seal and give it to me. In a bowl. Wash the bowl well. Don't let a soul touch the flacon. If you value your life. Swiftly, Jurga. Damn it, how this cart shakes. The flagon, Jurga."
"I have it. A drink, sir."
"Thanks. Now, pay attention. I'll soon fall asleep. I'll thrash around and rave, then lie as though dead. It's nothing. Don't be afeard."
"Lie still, sir, or the wound will open and you'll lose blood."
He fell back onto the skins, turned his head, and felt the merchant drape him in a sheepskin and a blanket stinking of horse sweat. The cart shook, and with each jolt, pangs of